Well, hey there, you sweet little scoundrels. I'm climbing out of my COVID cave this week to deliver a short and sweet episode as sort of a proof of life. Next week, the class of cults will resume, but in the meantime, I figured it would be a great way to acknowledge the start of the holiday season by talking about a topic that probably feels pretty relatable to us as we set about spending a bunch of money on gifts and festivities. That's right, I'm talking about bank robbery. Now let's just get something out of the way. I'm not bringing you folks any old run-of-the-mill capers here. Today, I'm going to talk about three elite champions of the craft. Yeah, sure, stealing is bad. But sometimes you just have to stand back and admire the sheer tenacity of someone looking to make a quick buck. Even if, like most criminals, they're usually undone by something really stupid. It's up to you whether you decide to treat these as cautionary tales, but if you do decide to go for it after listening to this episode, I'll have my Venmo in the show notes. Anyway, the first one that piqued my interest when I was researching for this show takes us all the way down to Fortaleza, Brazil, where a group of enterprising folks set themselves up a quaint little landscaping business, mostly specializing in real and artificial turf. They renovated the exterior of the building, painting it bright green, and invested in a truck with the company logo. The head of the operation, Luis Fernando Ribeiro, even walked the neighborhood handing out promotional flyers. Over the course of the next few months, people witnessed the proprietors hauling out lots of bags of sand and dirt, but they thought little of it given the nature of the business. Little did they know, these feisty little entrepreneurs were working on an underground project, 13 feet under the ground to be exact. Imagine something like Shawshank Redemption, only instead of busting out of prison, these guys are busting into a bank vault. The tunnel these guys dug was impressive all on its own. It was nearly 300 feet long, managing to go up and around a sewer pipe and making a few other little jogs along the way until it reached its final destination. It was reinforced with wooden walls, well lit, and even air conditioned. The people who designed and built this tunnel seemed very good at engineering and also seemed to have access to very important blueprints of the underground portion of the city. However, it was only about 28 inches in diameter, so it wasn't for us chunkier money gophers. On the morning of August 8, 2005, while the bank was closed over the weekend, the crew crawled through their tunnel and entered the basement of the central bank, at which point they used their various saws and torches and other cutting implements to break through nearly 4 feet of steel-reinforced concrete and into the bank's vault. Now, real quick, let's break down what's going on in this here vault. Apparently, a lot of this currency had been set aside because it was older and not sequentially numbered, and the bank was trying to determine whether to recirculate it or destroy it. You know how bank robbers and other criminals in movies are always asking for unmarked bills? It's still spendable, but it's also impossible for authorities to trace. Additionally, the money in this vault was apparently not insured against theft because the facility in which it was stored just wasn't as secure as it should have been, making the insurance premiums way too high. There were motion sensors and alarms, but they just weren't very good at their jobs. The thieves were able to avoid pretty much all of them as they made their way in and out of the vault with their hoard. And just how much money are we talking here? Well, the thieves managed to make away with roughly 160 million reais. That's the name of the Brazilian currency, by the way, or the equivalent of about 70 million American doll hairs. So ouch, big fat ouch. And all this cash weighed roughly 3 tons. And they managed to get it all through that 28-inch, 300-foot-long tunnel and into their getaway vans parked behind the store. And then they were off into the night. Perfect heist, right? Well, almost. See, the Brazilian government didn't take too kindly to this, as you can imagine. It was their central bank, And again, the loss was uninsured. Worst of all, it made them look really inept. It also seemed to indicate there was someone working on the inside who could provide the intel that the bank was sitting on millions of unmarked notes in a poorly secured bank vault. Likely, it was security guards, given some of the arrests that were made later on. At any rate, the federal police descended on this thing. Forensically, they didn't find a lot in the initial sweep. However, with so many people working in operation, some details were bound to slip. They covered the area in burnt lime to eliminate fingerprints, but they inevitably missed a few. Furthermore, someone had dropped a prepaid phone card in the tunnel, likely when they were trying to shuffle all that money out of there. And as anybody who spends time busting conspiracy theories will tell you, the problem with having such a big team for the commission of something bad, it only takes one or two people to send the whole thing crashing down. And that's more or less what happened here. Those fines all led to some suspects who flipped pretty easily, and that's when the police learned that the team had been working with a car dealership in Fortaleza. Police successfully pulled over a truck carrying several vehicles in which about 2 million reais were hidden for transport. Those arrests led to more arrests and the recovery of some of the money in little dribs and drabs. Most of those arrests were just hired to help build the tunnel, but there was still no sight of the mastermind or the big fat lump of cash that was still missing. Further, the police were able to use these arrests and phone taps that they made on that prepaid phone card that was found to gain intelligence on another similar heist the group was planning on an even bigger bank in Sao Paulo later that year, where closer to 200 million reais was at stake. They had built a tunnel about four times longer, but the police were watching closely and moved on them just as the group was about to pull off the score. As for this alleged mastermind, Luis Fernando Ribeiro, he escaped to Sao Paulo, but was eventually kidnapped in October of 2005 and held for nearly $1 million in ransom, which his family apparently paid, but to no avail. Ribeiro was found shot to death on a road just outside Rio de Janeiro. According to some articles I've read, some members of the police have been tied to this murder, but it's all still very unclear. Several other suspects have been found dead over the years, almost as if this money was cursed. But all told, after making dozens of arrests over the course of at least 5 years, the federal police have only ever recovered about 20 million of the 160 million stolen. Very interesting, no? By the way, if you want to know more about this whole case and investigation, there's a great three-part docuseries on Netflix about it called The Great Robbery of Brazil's Central Bank. Definitely worth checking out and provides a lot more inside information on the police procedures. Now, I want to pick up and bring you all the way back up here to the United States, only we're going back in time as well to around the 1870s, which is the start of the glory days of American bank robberies. You've probably already heard of the exploits of Jesse James and Billy the Kid and countless other Old West outlaws, but have you ever heard of George Leslie? Anyone? I'm willing to bet most of you are shaking your heads right now, but what if I told you that Mr. Leslie and his gang, between the years of 1869 and 1878, was estimated by police to have been responsible for up to 80%, that's 80, of the bank robberies in the US? I was surprised too. You'd think such a cunning mastermind would have been minted among other legends we now know, but it might have had something to do with the way he was brought down. The architect turned king of bank robbers, as he was dubbed, didn't meet his demise at the hand of a legendary cop shootout, nor did he get caught and serve his remaining days out in prison, as so many of these guys did. If that had happened, his story might have been printed on stronger stuff. But before we get to what happened to him, let's talk a little about George Leslie himself. I already mentioned he was an architect, which put him into some pretty elevated social circles as a college-educated man. By the time he arrived in New York, both of his parents were deceased, and he had no siblings. And so when he departed his hometown of Cincinnati, Ohio, telling friends and colleagues he intended to make some easy money, little did they know he planned to do it by rather illicit means. He was 27 years old at the time and apparently quite the dashing, handsome type. Consider this a bit of foreshadowing, by the way. He also came from a little bit of money during the time of the Civil War, which allowed his father, a successful brewer in Cincinnati, to buy his son out of conscription for the sum of $300, a perfectly legal, albeit controversial thing at the time. As you can imagine, this didn't go over well with the folks he lived around. Ohio alone contributed nearly 250,000 soldiers to the Union Army, and they considered people like the Leslies worse than deserters. So George was looking for a fresh start in a place where no one knew him. There is no better place for that, even today, than the Big Apple. And it would just so happen there are a few places more suited to rob the rich and elite than a city that housed the likes of the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, and the Vanderbilts, all of whom preferred to store their cash, stocks, bonds, and jewels in local banks. And Leslie was extremely meticulous. I can't put too fine a point on that. If one could be a surgeon of breaking and entering, it was this guy. He would draw up blueprints of every bank he robbed, and he would then use a warehouse to build a mock-up so he could rehearse again and again. He also made use of a special device called a little joker, which was covertly installed beneath the combination knob of a bank safe. As business throughout the day wore on and the safe was opened, the numbers would leave an imprint on the device. While it wouldn't tell you the order of the combination, it definitely narrowed the field enough so it could be cracked in a much shorter period, all without the need for pesky things like guns, saws, or dynamite, which could destroy the loot inside. While it did require someone to technically break into the bank twice, one to place the little joker and again to make off with the loot, George Leslie was just the sort of person with the patience and confidence to pull that off. Do I need to tell you what this sounds like? A dashing, handsome thief with a strict attention to the minutest detail and a tightly managed crew who pulled off jobs so flawlessly and cleverly, all while hurting no one or damaging any property, that the police had no idea how they got away with it. This is some 19th century Ocean's 11 stuff. Please tell me again why most of us have never heard of these guys before. Anyway, after a long series of bank robberies over the next decade and change, which included knocking over the Ocean National Bank for $1.6 million and the Northampton Bank in Massachusetts for around $750,000, Leslie's crown jewel of a heist was the Manhattan Savings Institution in 1878. This was going to be his final job, one that would make him enough money to retire from the business and build a new life somewhere out west. He had a wife who departed to Philadelphia to wait for their eventual escape. He spent more than 3 years putting these plans together, studying that building down to the individual bolt and screw, but there was a problem. And there's always a problem. But this one had nothing to do with Leslie's competence as a thief. He had a bit of a wandering eye when it came to the ladies, and he was apparently having an affair with the wife of one of his accomplices, Shang Draper. Shang caught wind of this when he found a note from the wife, whose name was Babe Draper, by the way, asking to meet Leslie for one final smash session before the heist. About a month later, police discovered George Leslie's body in a patch of woods out in Yonkers. Someone had shot him in the head and the heart, and they never managed to officially solve the case. However, police were able to eventually piece together that Shang Draper likely had done the deed out of revenge. But it came as a huge surprise to Leslie's rich pals in the city because they had no idea about his double life. It wasn't until his cohorts pulled off that big heist in his absence and were eventually caught that they were able to put all the pieces together and peg Leslie as the mastermind they'd been after the whole time. Also, his lady lover, Babe Draper, was found in the water at the base of the Brooklyn Bridge with her throat slit. Eventually, nearly all the assets from this robbery were recovered. That's because most of what was in the safe at the Manhattan Savings Institution was stocks and bonds, which could not be easily converted into cash. The remainder of that haul, which totaled about $15,000, was lost to the winds. Some might say the moral of the story would be to not get involved with robbing banks, but that was something George Leslie had very much on lock. The only tool he seemed unable to control was the one in his pants. But lest you think cash, gold, and jewels are the only targets of enterprising thieves, think again. History is riddled with all kinds of crazy heists, like the time in 2008 when villagers in Komarovo, Russia, managed to steal an entire church. Yes, that's right, a building, by selling it one brick at a time to a local businessman for a ruble apiece. And in 2016, the Wisconsin cheese heists saw a series of thefts of Parmesan cheese wheels, some of the hauls weighing up to 70,000 pounds. In some cases, the cheese was eventually recovered in abandoned trucks, likely when the thieves discovered it was a lot harder to unload cheese on the black market than they thought. That's because cheese is heavily regulated by the USDA, and most legitimate buyers, your stores, your restaurants, and the like, know better than to buy any parm that has its seal broken, which is a violation of federal law. Furthermore, some of these thieves were trying to sell it off at a buck per pound, far too cheap for anyone who knows their cheese to think it was a copacetic deal. Although that being said, if someone came up to me and asked if I wanted to buy some cheese for a dollar a pound, especially Parmigiano Reggiano or something like that, I gotta say I probably would buy approximately 50 pounds of cheese, but that's just me. Now, lest you think this is funny, a few tons of cheese stolen from a single cheesemaker, as happened here, could be enough to put some folks out of business. Furthermore, most of these cheese thieves have yet to be caught. They're still out there. They're still at large. So no one can say for sure where the goods ended up. One thing they can say is the work it takes to make off with several tons of product and not get caught takes a level of sophistication that can't be easily shrugged off. We're talking possibly an inside job yet again. So next time you're visiting an Olive Garden and you're sitting idly by as the server cranks a mountain of fromage onto your spaghetti, feel free to wonder if it might have been stolen. Well, folks, that's going to do it for me for this week's episode. As I said at the beginning, the Class of Cults will resume next week, but I hope you enjoyed this quick little diversion into the shadowy realm of breaking and entering. I'll have all the links you need in the show notes to learn more about these cases I've talked about today, and there's no doubt I'll eventually make a whole season involving the crazy capers humans have pulled off over the centuries. I haven't even begun to talk about art theft yet, and that, my friends, is a doozy. If you have any cases you'd like for me to cover, please reach out to me at ddarknesstime@gmail.com or over on the Facebook page or on Twitter. I love getting ideas from listeners, but I also just love hearing from you in general, so please don't be shy. I'll see you again next week. In the meantime, you know what to do. Be good, you little ding-dongs.